Chapter 16, Gastrointestinal and Urologic Emergencies. Introduction. Abdominal pain is a common complaint, but the cause is often difficult to identify, even for a physician. As an EMT, you do not need to determine the exact cause of acute abdominal pain, but it is helpful for you to understand the pathophysiology and the signs and symptoms of common illnesses. You need to be able to recognize a life-threatening problem and act swiftly in response. Remember, the patient is in pain and is probably anxious, requiring your skills of rapid assessment and emotional support. Anatomy and physiology. The abdominal cavity contains solid and hollow organs that make up the gastrointestinal, genital, and urinary systems. Solid organs include the liver, spleen, pancreas, kidneys, and ovaries in women. Technically, organs such as the kidneys, ovaries, and the pancreas are retroperitoneal, behind the peritoneum. However, because they lie next to the peritoneum, they can cause abdominal pain. An injury to a solid organ can cause shock and bleeding because of the amount of blood vessels that the organ holds. Hollow organs include the gallbladder, stomach, small intestine, large intestine, and urinary bladder. If there is a breach into one of these hollow organs, the contents of the organ will leak and contaminate the abdominal cavity. The gastrointestinal system. The gastrointestinal system is responsible for the digestion process. Digestion begins when the food is put into the mouth and chewed. The salivary glands secrete saliva and begin to break the food down. Then it is swallowed. The food travels down the esophagus to the stomach. The stomach is the main organ of the digestive system. Most digestion takes place in the stomach, where gastric juices break the food down to a form that can be used by the body. The liver assists in digestion by secreting bile, which aids in the digestion of fats. The liver also filters toxic substances produced by digestion, creates glucose stores, and produces substances necessary for blood clotting and immune function. The gallbladder is a hollow pouch that acts as a reservoir for bile. Food then travels down into the small intestine, which consists of three sections: the duodenum, jejunum, and ileum. The duodenum is where digestive juices from the pancreas and liver mix together. The pancreas aids digestion by secreting juice that contains enzymes that help break down starches, fats, and proteins. It also releases amylase. Amylase is responsible for breaking down starches into sugar and is present in saliva and the duodenum. In the duodenum, amylase comes from the pancreas, where it is manufactured. Bicarbonate, an alkali, is part of the buffering system that neutralizes stomach acid in the duodenum. Bicarbonate is also produced in the pancreas. Insulin, too, is produced in the pancreas, which regulates the amount of glucose in the bloodstream. The jejunum plays a major role in the absorption of digestive products. In fact, the jejunum comprises much of the surface area of the small intestine and does much of the work. Because the breakdown of proteins, fats, and starches occurs earlier in the digestive system, the jejunum and ileum are a mostly pH-neutral environment for absorption. The jejunum connects the duodenum to the ileum, and the ileum is where soluble molecules are absorbed into the blood. It is here that proteins, fats, and starches are reduced to amino acids, fatty acids, and simple sugars. The food that was not broken down and used as nutrients then moves into the colon or large intestine as waste products. A rhythmic movement called peristalsis moves the waste matter through the intestines. Water is absorbed and stool is formed that passes through the rectum to the anus, where it is defecated. The spleen is also located in the abdomen but has no digestive system function. The spleen is part of the lymphatic system and plays a significant role in relation to red blood cells and the immune system. It assists in the filtration of blood, aids in the development of red blood cells, and serves as a blood reservoir. The spleen also produces antibodies. The genital system. The abdominal space also holds the male and female reproductive organs. The male reproductive system consists of the testicles, epididymis, vasa deferentia, seminal vesicles, prostate gland, and penis. The female reproductive system includes the ovaries, fallopian tubes, uterus, cervix, and the vagina. The urinary system. The urinary system controls the discharge of certain waste materials filtered from the blood by the kidneys. In the urinary system, the kidneys are solid organs. The ureters, bladder, and urethra are hollow organs. Ordinarily, the urinary and genital systems are considered together because they share many organs. One system can directly affect the other. For example, if the prostate gland in the male genital system enlarges, then the urethra will narrow, weakening the bladder and eventually leading to urinary retention. The body contains two kidneys, one on each side, that lie on the posterior muscular wall of the abdomen, behind the peritoneum, in the retroperitoneal space. The kidneys play an important role in the regulation of acidity and blood pressure. Blood pressure regulation is associated with the kidney's ability to remove sodium chloride from the body, and therefore excess fluid. The most common cause of secondary hypertension is kidney disease. The kidneys rid the body of toxic wastes and control the body's balance of fluid and electrolytes. Blood flow in the kidneys is high. Nearly 20% of the output of blood from the heart passes through the kidneys each minute. Large vessels attach the kidneys directly to the aorta and the inferior vena cava. Waste products and water are constantly filtered from the blood to form urine. The kidneys continuously concentrate this filtered urine by reabsorbing the water as it passes through a system of specialized tubes within them. The tubes finally unite to form the renal pelvis, a cone-shaped collecting area that connects the ureter and the kidney. Normally, each kidney drains its urine into one ureter through which the urine passes to the bladder. A ureter passes from the renal pelvis of each kidney along the surface of the posterior abdominal wall behind the peritoneum to drain into the urinary bladder. The ureters are small, 0.2 inches in diameter, hollow, muscular tubes. Peristalsis, a wave-like contraction of smooth muscle, occurs in these tubes to move the urine to the bladder. The urinary bladder is located immediately behind the pubic symphysis in the pelvic cavity and is composed of smooth muscle with a specialized lining membrane. The two ureters enter posteriorly at its base on either side. The bladder empties to the outside of the body through the urethra. In the male, the urethra passes from the anterior base of the bladder through the penis. In the female, the urethra opens at the front of the vagina. The normal adult forms 1.5 to 2 liters of urine every day. This waste is extracted and concentrated from the 1,500 liters of blood that circulate through the kidneys daily. Pathophysiology. The abdominal cavity is lined by a membrane called the peritoneum. The peritoneum also covers the organs of the abdomen. The parietal peritoneum lines the abdominal cavity, and the visceral peritoneum covers the organs themselves. The abdominal space normally contains a small amount of peritoneal fluid to bathe and lubricate the organs in the abdominal cavity. Any foreign material, such as blood, pus, bile, pancreatic juice, or amniotic fluid, can cause irritation of the peritoneum, called peritonitis. Acute abdomen is a medical term referring to the sudden onset of abdominal pain, often associated with severe progressive problems that require medical attention. Peritonitis will usually develop if the acute abdomen is not treated and can be fatal. Peritonitis typically causes ileus or paralysis of the muscular contractions that normally propel material through the intestine. The retained gas and feces in turn cause abdominal distension. In the presence of such paralysis, nothing that is eaten can pass normally out of the stomach or through the bowel. In this situation, the only way the stomach can empty itself is by emesis, or vomiting. For this reason, peritonitis is almost always associated with nausea and vomiting. These symptoms do not point to a particular cause because they can accompany almost every type of gastrointestinal disease or injury. To gauge the degree of distension, simply look at the patient's abdomen. Distension begins shortly after muscular contractions of the bowel have ceased. The patient's pulse and blood pressure may change significantly or not at all. These findings reflect the severity of the process, its duration, and the amount of fluid lost into the abdomen. Peritonitis is also associated with a loss of body fluid into the abdominal cavity. The loss of fluid usually results from abnormal shifts of fluid from the bloodstream into body tissues. This fluid shift decreases the volume of circulating blood and may lead to decreased blood pressure or even shock. The patient may have normal vital signs, or if the peritonitis has progressed farther, the patient may present with tachycardia and hypotension. When peritonitis is accompanied by hemorrhage, the signs of shock are much more apparent. Fever may or may not be present, depending on the cause of the peritonitis. Patients with diverticulitis or cholecystitis, inflammation of the gallbladder, may have a substantial elevation in temperature. However, patients with acute appendicitis may have a temperature within normal limits until the appendix ruptures and an abscess starts to form. Abdominal pain. Two different types of nerve supply the peritoneum, and therefore abdominal pain can have different qualities. The parietal peritoneum is supplied by the same nerves from the spinal cord that supply the skin of the abdomen. It can therefore perceive much of the same sensations: pain, touch, pressure, heat, and cold. These sensory nerves can easily identify and localize a point of irritation. In contrast, the visceral peritoneum is supplied by the autonomic nervous system. These nerves are far less able to localize sensation. What this means for you is that your patient will not be able to localize and describe exactly where the pain is. The visceral peritoneum is stimulated when distension or contraction of the hollow abdominal organs activates the stretch receptors. Patients sometimes describe it as a deep pain. Other painful sensations that occur because of an irritated visceral peritoneum may be perceived at a distant point on the surface of the body, such as the back or shoulder. This phenomenon is called referred pain. Referred pain is the result of connections between the body's two separate nervous systems. The nerves connecting the somatic nervous system and autonomic nervous system cause the stimulation of the autonomic nerves to be perceived as stimulation of the spinal sensory nerves. For example, acute cholecystitis may cause pain in the right shoulder because the autonomic nerves serving the gallbladder lie near the spinal cord at the same anatomic level as the spinal sensory nerves that supply the skin of the shoulder. The most common abdominal emergencies with most common locations of direct and referred pain are listed in Table 16.1. Causes of acute abdomen. Almost any problem with an abdominal organ can cause an acute abdomen. Some of the more common causes are discussed here. Because the visceral peritoneum is usually irritated first, early abdominal pain tends to be vague and poorly localized. As the parietal peritoneum becomes irritated, pain becomes more severe and may be more specifically located. Ulcers. The stomach and duodenum are subjected to high levels of acidity. To prevent damage to these organs, protective layers of mucus line both organs. In peptic ulcer disease, PUD, the protective layer is eroded, allowing the acid to eat into the organ itself over the course of weeks, months, or even years. Most peptic ulcers are the result of infection of the stomach with Helicobacter pylori. Another major cause is chronic use of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, NSAIDs. Alcohol and smoking can also affect the severity of PUD by increasing gastric acidity. PUD affects both men and women equally, but tends to occur more often in the older population. As people age, the immune system's ability to fight infection decreases, making infection more likely. The geriatric population in general also uses NSAIDs frequently for arthritis and other musculoskeletal conditions. Patients with peptic ulcers experience a classic sequence of burning or gnawing pain in the stomach that subsides or diminishes immediately after eating and then reemerges 2 to 3 hours later. The pain usually presents in the upper abdomen, but sometimes may be found below the sternum. With some patients, the pain occurs immediately after eating. Nausea, vomiting, belching, and heartburn are common symptoms. If the erosion is severe, gastric bleeding can occur, resulting in hematemesis and melena, black, tarry stools containing blood. Some ulcers will heal without medical intervention, but often complications can occur from bleeding or perforation, a hole through the wall of the stomach. More serious ulcerative conditions can cause severe peritonitis and an acute abdomen. Gallstones. The gallbladder is a storage pouch for digestive juices and waste from the liver. Gallstones can form and block the outlet from the gallbladder, causing pain. Sometimes the blockage will pass, but if not, it can lead to severe inflammation of the gallbladder, called cholecystitis. This is a condition in which the wall of the gallbladder becomes inflamed. In severe cases, the gallbladder may rupture, causing inflammation to spread and irritate surrounding structures, such as the diaphragm and bowel. This condition presents as a constant, severe pain in the right upper or mid-abdominal region and may refer to the right upper back, shoulder area, or flank. The pain may steadily increase for hours or may come and go. Cholecystitis commonly produces symptoms about 30 minutes after a particularly fatty meal, and usually at night. Other symptoms include general gastrointestinal distress, such as nausea and vomiting, indigestion, bloating, gas, and belching. Pancreatitis. The pancreas forms digestive juices and is also the source of insulin. Inflammation of the pancreas is called pancreatitis. Pancreatitis can be caused by an obstructing gallstone, alcohol abuse, and other diseases. Severe pain may present in the upper left and right quadrants and may often radiate to the back. Other signs and symptoms accompanying the pain are nausea and vomiting, abdominal distension, and tenderness. Complications like sepsis or hemorrhage can occur, in which case assessment may also reveal fever or tachycardia. Appendicitis. The appendix is a small recess in the large intestine. Inflammation or infection in the appendix is called appendicitis and is a frequent cause of acute abdomen. This inflammation can eventually cause the tissues to die and/or rupture, causing an abscess, peritonitis, or shock. Initially, the pain caused by appendicitis is more generalized, dull, and diffuse, and may center in the umbilical area. The pain later localizes to the right lower quadrant of the abdomen. Appendicitis can also cause referred pain. The patient may also report nausea and vomiting, anorexia, lack of appetite for food, fever and chills. A classic symptom of appendicitis is rebound tenderness. Rebound tenderness is a result of peritoneal irritation. This can be assessed by pressing down gently and firmly on the abdomen. The patient will feel pain when the pressure is released. Women who are pregnant may not exhibit this symptom. Gastrointestinal hemorrhage. Bleeding within the gastrointestinal tract is a symptom of another disease, not a disease itself. Gastrointestinal hemorrhage can be acute, which may be shorter term and more severe, or chronic, which may be of longer duration and less severe. All complaints of bleeding should be considered serious. A gastrointestinal hemorrhage can occur in the upper or lower gastrointestinal tract. Bleeding in the upper gastrointestinal tract occurs from the esophagus to the upper small intestine. In the esophagus, problems might include esophagitis, esophageal varices, or Mallory-Weiss syndrome. Lower gastrointestinal bleeding occurs between the upper part of the small intestine and the anus. Bowel inflammation, diverticulitis, and hemorrhoids are common causes of bleeding in the lower gastrointestinal tract. Esophagitis. Esophagitis occurs when the lining of the esophagus becomes inflamed by infection or from the acids in the stomach. Gastroesophageal reflux disease. The patient may report pain when swallowing and complain of feeling like an object is stuck in his or her throat. Additional symptoms include heartburn, nausea, vomiting, and sores in the mouth. In the worst cases, bleeding can occur from the small capillary vessels within the esophageal lining or the main blood vessels. Esophageal varices. Esophageal varices occur when the amount of pressure within the blood vessels surrounding the esophagus increases. The esophageal blood vessels eventually deposit their blood into the portal system. If the liver becomes damaged and blood cannot flow through it easily, blood begins to back up into these portal vessels, dilating the vessels and causing the capillary network of the esophagus to begin leaking. If pressure continues to build, the vessel walls may fail, causing bleeding. In industrialized countries, alcohol is the main cause of portal hypertension. Long-term alcohol consumption damages the interior of the liver, cirrhosis, leading to slower blood flow. In developing countries, viral hepatitis is the main cause of liver damage. Presentation of esophageal varices takes two forms. Initially, the patient shows signs of liver disease, fatigue, weight loss, jaundice, anorexia, edema in the abdomen, abdominal pain, nausea, and vomiting. This very gradual disease process takes months to years before the patient reaches a state of extreme discomfort. By contrast, the rupture of the varices is far more sudden. The patient will complain of sudden onset discomfort in the throat. He or she may have severe difficulty swallowing, vomiting of bright red blood, hypotension, and signs of shock. If the bleeding is less dramatic, hematemesis, vomiting blood, and melena, black tarry stools, are likely. Regardless of the speed of bleeding, damage to these vessels can be life-threatening. Spontaneous rupture is often life-threatening, and significant blood loss at the scene may be evident. Major ruptures can lead to death in a matter of minutes. Mallory-Weiss syndrome. Mallory-Weiss syndrome may lead to severe hemorrhage. In this condition, the junction between the esophagus and the stomach tears, causing severe bleeding and potentially death. Primary risk factors include alcoholism and eating disorders. Mallory-Weiss syndrome affects both men and women equally, but is more prevalent in older adults and older children. Vomiting is the principal symptom. In women, this syndrome may be associated with severe vomiting related to pregnancy. The extent of the bleeding can range from very minor bleeding, resulting in very little blood loss, to severe bleeding and extreme fluid loss. In extreme cases, patients may experience signs and symptoms of shock, upper abdominal pain, hematemesis, and melena. Gastroenteritis. Acute gastroenteritis comprises a family of conditions revolving around a central theme of infection combined with diarrhea, nausea, and vomiting. Bacterial and viral organisms can cause this condition. These organisms typically enter the body through contaminated food or water. Patients may begin to experience an upset stomach and diarrhea as soon as several hours or several days after contact with the contaminated matter. The disease can then run its course in 2 to 3 days or continue for several weeks. Gastroenteritis is not an infectious disease, but has all of the hallmarks of its acute infectious cousin. Patients with this condition experience nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea from a non-infectious cause, such as medications, toxins from shellfish, or chemotherapy. Diarrhea is the principal symptom in both types of gastroenteritis. Patients may experience large dumping-type diarrhea or frequent small liquid stools. The diarrhea may contain blood and/or pus, and it may have a foul odor or be odorless. Abdominal cramping is frequently reported. Nausea, vomiting, fever, and anorexia are also present. If the diarrhea continues, dehydration will result. As the volume of fluid loss increases, the likelihood of shock increases. Diverticulitis. Diverticulitis was first recognized around 1900, when the types of foods people ate began to change dramatically. In particular, the amount of fiber within the U.S. diet plummeted as the amount of processed foods eaten increased. As the amount of fiber consumed as part of the diet decreases, the consistency of the normal stool becomes more solid. This hard stool requires more intestinal contractions, subsequently increasing pressure within the colon. In this environment, small defects within the colonic wall that would otherwise never pose a problem now fail, resulting in bulges in the wall. These small outcroppings eventually turn into pouches, called diverticula. As feces travel through the colon, some may become trapped within these pouches. When bacteria grow there, they cause localized inflammation and infection. The main symptom of diverticulitis is abdominal pain, which tends to be localized to the left side of the lower abdomen. Classic signs of infection include fever, malaise, body aches, chills, nausea, and vomiting. Bleeding is rare with this condition. Because of the local infections of these pouches, adhesions may develop, narrowing the diameter of the colon and resulting in constipation and bowel obstruction. Hemorrhoids. Hemorrhoids are created by swelling and inflammation of the blood vessels surrounding the rectum. They are a common problem, with almost half the population having at least one hemorrhoid by age 50 years. Hemorrhoids may result from conditions that increase pressure on the rectum or irritation of the rectum, pregnancy, straining at stool, and chronic constipation cause increased pressure. Diarrhea can cause irritation. Hemorrhoids present as bright red blood during defecation. This bleeding tends to be minimal and is easily controlled. Additionally, patients may experience itching and a small mass on the rectum. Typically, this mass is a clot formed in response to the mild bleeding. Urinary system. Issues in the urinary system can cause acute abdominal pain. Bladder inflammation, called cystitis, is common, especially in women. This condition is generally caused by a bacterial infection and can be referred to as a urinary tract infection, UTI. A bladder infection can be painful. Patients with cystitis usually have lower quadrant abdominal pain. They also may report an urgency and frequency in urination and pressure and pain around the bladder. If the infection is severe, the urethra can become inflamed, causing urinary retention. When you are assessing a patient with cystitis, the patient may report tenderness when you are palpating the abdomen over the bladder, just above the pubic bone. Cystitis can become a serious health problem if the infection spreads to the kidneys. Kidneys. The kidneys play a major role in maintaining homeostasis, or keeping all body systems in balance. The kidneys preserve this balance by eliminating waste from the blood. When the kidneys fail, the patient loses the ability to excrete waste from the body, leading to a condition called uremia. This means that the waste product, urea, which is normally excreted into the urine, remains in the blood. Urine drains from the kidney through a narrow tube called the ureter through to the bladder. Chemicals may crystallize in the urine and form kidney stones, renal calculi. Kidney stones can grow over time, and if a stone passes into the ureter, it can cause a blockage. Pressure will build up behind the kidney stone and cause swelling in the kidney. Patients with a kidney stone blockage may initially report vague discomfort in the flank, but the pain can become quite intense within 60 minutes and typically will radiate to the groin. These patients are often agitated and restless as they try to get into a comfortable position to relieve the pain. They may also report nausea and vomiting. The pain from kidney stones is often caused when the stone moves within the ureter. In many cases, the stone will pass on its own, but in other cases, it may have to be surgically removed or broken up. A slight amount of blood in the urine, hematuria, after the stone passes may be present because of irritation of the ureter. Kidney renal failure can be acute or chronic. Acute renal failure is a sudden, possibly over a period of days, decrease in function. It occurs from a variety of causes, including hemorrhage, dehydration, trauma, shock, sepsis, heart failure, medications, drug abuse, and kidney stones. Acute renal failure can be reversed with prompt diagnosis and treatment. Chronic renal failure is irreversible. It is progressive and develops over months and years. It is often caused by diabetes or hypertension. The kidney tissue shrinks and function diminishes. Eventually, the patient requires dialysis or a kidney transplant to remove waste products from the bloodstream. Patients with chronic renal failure exhibit several signs and symptoms, beginning with an altered level of consciousness. In later stages, seizures and coma are possible. Additional signs and symptoms include lethargy, nausea, headaches, cramps, and edema in the extremities and face because of fluid imbalances. Female reproductive organs. Gynecologic problems are a common cause of acute abdominal pain. Always consider that a woman with lower quadrant abdominal pain and tenderness may have a problem related to her ovaries, fallopian tubes, or uterus. Chapter 21, Gynecologic Emergencies, covers gynecologic emergencies in depth. Other organ systems. The aorta lies immediately behind the peritoneum. In older people, the wall of the aorta sometimes develops weak areas that swell to form an abdominal aortic aneurysm, AAA. A pulsating mass may be felt in the abdomen, although this is a rare sign and is often hard to detect. Use extreme caution when trying to assess or detect this condition. The development of an aneurysm is rarely associated with symptoms because it occurs slowly. But if the aneurysm tears and ruptures, massive hemorrhage may occur, and the patient will present with signs of acute peritoneal irritation. The patient may also report radiation of severe pain to the back because the peritoneum can be stripped away from the wall of the main abdominal cavity by the hemorrhage. Back pain is a common symptom when an aneurysm has started to expand and the aortic linings begin to tear. Back pain that cannot be easily explained should be investigated closely in patients who are suspected of having an AAA. The patient generally describes the pain as tearing, which is different than most other complaints of abdominal pain. The association of acute abdominal signs and symptoms of shock requires prompt transportation. Because this is a fragile situation with a large leaking artery, avoid unnecessary or vigorous palpation of the abdomen and do not aggressively treat the patient for shock because these actions can cause a small tear to expand. Remember to handle the patient gently during transport. Pneumonia, especially in the lower parts of the lung, may cause both ileus and abdominal pain. In this situation, the problem lies in an adjacent body cavity, but the intense inflammatory response can reflect in the abdomen. A hernia is a protrusion of an organ or tissue through a hole or opening into a body cavity where it does not belong. Hernias can occur as a result of the following. A congenital defect, as around the umbilicus. A surgical wound that has failed to heal properly. A natural weakness in an area such as in the groin. Hernias do not always produce a mass or lump that the patient will notice. At times, the mass will disappear back into the body cavity in which it belongs. In this case, the hernia is said to be reducible. If the mass cannot be pushed back within the body, it is said to be incarcerated. Reducible hernias pose little risk to the patient. Some people live with them for years. When a hernia is incarcerated, however, its contents may become seriously compressed by the surrounding tissue, eventually compromising the blood supply. This situation, called strangulation, is a serious medical emergency. Immediate surgery is required to remove any dead tissue and repair the hernia. The following signs and symptoms indicate a serious hernia problem. A formerly reducible mass is no longer reducible. Pain at the hernia site. Tenderness when the hernia is palpated. Red or blue skin discoloration over the hernia. Any of these signs and symptoms is cause for prompt transport to the emergency department. Patient assessment. Scene size up. Scene safety. Your first action should always be to ensure that the scene is safe. Follow standard precautions with a minimum of gloves and eye protection. Consider donning a gown and covering your shoes with disposable protective covers, because often there may be feces and urine on the floor, and some patients may have active projectile vomiting. As you proceed to the patient, observe the scene for safety threats to yourself and your partner, and determine the number of patients at the scene. If your call involves going to the patient's home and he or she does not come to the door, the patient may have had a syncopal episode, fainted. Request police assistance to help you gain access to the patient. Consider the need for additional or specialized medical resources. Call for additional resources earlier rather than later. Mechanism of injury, nature of illness. You will need to look for clues to help you determine the nature of illness, NOI, or the mechanism of injury. Acute abdomen can be the result of violence, such as blunt or penetrating trauma, so always be vigilant. Chapter 28, Abdominal and Genitourinary Injuries, discusses traumatic injuries in detail. Clues will help you develop an early index of suspicion for life threats. For example, a pale and sweating patient who reports tearing pain may have an AAA. Observe the scene closely and interview bystanders or family members if the NOI is not obvious. In some cases, your senses can help give you a clue as to the NOI. For example, gastrointestinal bleeding often has a characteristic odor that you will learn to recognize. Primary assessment. As you begin to assess the patient, remember that your first priority is to look for and treat any life-threatening conditions. Assess the patient's level of consciousness. Assess the patient's ABCs. Threats to airway, breathing, or circulation are considered life-threatening and must be treated immediately. Perform a rapid scan. Note the position of the patient. Commonly, the patient will have his or her knees drawn up to help alleviate the pain associated with acute abdomen. Consider necessary treatment and transportation options and the need for early advanced life support, ALS, assistance. Form a general impression. Approach the patient and ask him or her about the chief complaint. A description of the current problem in the patient's own words should help you to identify where to begin your assessment. If the chief complaint indicates a life-threatening problem, assess and treat it immediately. If the chief complaint is a minor problem, it should wait until you have had a chance to assess for and treat any potential life threats. The patient's level of consciousness, using the AVPU, alert to person, place, and day, responsive to verbal stimuli, responsive to pain, unresponsive, scale, should be included in your general impression. Airway and breathing. Ensure that the patient's airway is clear and that the patient's respirations are adequate. Administer oxygen to the patient when needed. As a result of the abdominal pain, the patient may show shallow or inadequate respirations because deep breaths often intensify the pain. Circulation. When you are assessing the patient's circulation, remember to assess for major bleeding. Ask the patient about blood in the vomit, hematemesis, or black tarry stools, melena. The patient's pulse rate and quality, as well as skin condition, may indicate shock. Check the pulses in both arms because a difference in pulse strength may indicate an AAA. Shock may be caused by hypovolemia or may be the result of a severe infection, septic. If evidence of shock, inadequate perfusion, is present, intervention should include high-flow oxygen, elevating the patient's legs 6 inches to 12 inches by placing a pillow or blanket underneath the knees and lower legs, or to a position of comfort, and keeping the patient warm. Ensure that you provide prompt treatment for life threats and do not delay in providing transport. Transport decision. Certain patients should be transported quickly. These include patients who have airway, breathing, or circulation problems, including problems with pulse and perfusion, and patients with suspected internal bleeding. Included in the group to package quickly and transport rapidly are patients who have a poor general impression, especially pediatric and geriatric patients. Pale, cool, diaphoretic skin, tachycardia, hypotension, and altered level of consciousness are all signs of significant illness. Ensure that the ride during transport is as gentle as possible for the patient. Drive smoothly and steadily. Rapid driving can result in increased vehicle movement, potentially aggravating and possibly worsening the patient's abdominal pain. History taking. Investigate chief complaint. The chief complaint is often based on a patient's previous history of chronic medical problems. This history includes information expressed in the patient's own words, subjective, and what you observe through physical assessment, objective. The patient history should also include the patient's general state of health, surgeries or recent hospitalizations, and any traumatic injuries. Sample history. If the patient is responsive, begin with obtaining the sample history. Ask the following questions specific to the signs and symptoms of gastrointestinal or urologic emergency. Nausea and vomiting. Do you feel nauseous? Have you vomited? How many times? Over what period of time? Was there red blood? Did it look like coffee grounds? Changes in bowel habits. Has there been any change in your bowel habits? Have you been constipated? Did the stool look dark and tarry? Have you had diarrhea? Was there any red blood in it? Urination. Have you been urinating more or less often? Is there pain when you urinate? Is the color dark or unusual? Is there an unusual odor? Weight loss. Have you lost weight recently? How many pounds? Belching or flatulence. Have you experienced belching or flatulence? For how long? Pain. What does the pain feel like? How long have you had this pain? Is the pain constant or intermittent? Other. Ask about any other signs or symptoms related to this complaint, such as, are there any changes you have noted recently that may be contributing to your pain? Concurrent chest pain. If the patient reports chest pain, use OPQRST, onset, provocation, palliation, quality, region, radiation, severity, and timing of pain, to ask the patient what makes the pain better or worse. Continue with the sample history. Does the patient have any allergies? What are the patient's current medications? Determine the patient's general state of health through the pertinent past history. Has the patient experienced this kind of abdominal pain before? If the patient is female and of childbearing age, determine the date of her last menstrual period. This will determine if the patient could possibly be pregnant or raise the suspicion of an ectopic pregnancy. Has the patient had any surgery or recent hospitalizations? Ask the patient about his or her last oral intake. It is important to determine whether the patient has ingested any substance that could be causing the acute abdomen. If eating causes pain, discomfort, vomiting, or diarrhea, the patient will eat less often or stop eating. Do not give the patient anything by mouth. Food or fluid may only aggravate many of the symptoms. Also, the presence of food in the stomach increases the risk of aspiration. Finally, determine the events that led up to the patient's present illness. It is important to determine whether this is a medical emergency or related to trauma. Therefore, you need to question the patient about any recent trauma. The sample history may not affect the interventions you perform, but it will help provide needed information for the physician in the emergency department to aid in determining the cause of the acute abdomen. Secondary assessment. If the secondary assessment is not performed at the scene, it is performed in the back of the ambulance en route to the hospital. However, there will be situations when you may not have time to perform a secondary assessment if you have to continually manage life threats that were identified during the primary assessment. If the patient is stable and has an isolated complaint, the secondary assessment may occur at the scene. In some situations, patients are comfortable only when lying in one particular position, which tends to relax muscles adjacent to the inflamed organ and thus lessen the pain. Therefore, the position of the patient may provide you with an important clue. For example, a patient with appendicitis may draw up the right knee. A patient with pancreatitis may lie curled up on one side. Physical examinations. Information gathered in the history-taking portion of the patient assessment may be used to focus your physical examination of the abdomen. A normal abdomen is soft and not tender to the touch. Pain and tenderness are the most common symptoms of an acute abdomen. The pain may be sharply localized or diffuse and will vary in its severity. Localized pain gives a clue to the problem organ or area causing it. Tenderness may be minimal or so great that the patient will not allow you to touch the abdomen. In some instances, the muscles of the abdominal wall become rigid in an involuntary effort to protect the abdomen from further irritation. This board-like muscle spasm, called guarding, can be seen with major problems such as a perforated ulcer or pancreatitis. Remember, the patient with peritonitis usually has abdominal pain even when lying quietly. The patient may have difficulty breathing and may take rapid, shallow breaths because of the pain. Usually, you will find tenderness on palpation of the abdomen or when the patient moves. The degree of pain and tenderness is usually related directly to the severity of peritoneal inflammation. Use the following steps to assess the abdomen. 1. Explain to the patient what you are going to do in terms of assessing the abdomen. 2. Place the patient in a supine position with the legs drawn up and flexed at the knees to relax the abdominal muscles, unless there is any trauma, in which case the patient will remain supine and stabilized. Determine whether the patient is restless or quiet and whether motion causes pain. 3. Expose the abdomen and visually assess it. Does the abdomen appear distended, enlarged? Do you see any pulsating masses? Indicates an aortic aneurysm. Is there bruising to the abdominal wall? 4. Ask the patient where the pain is most intense. Palpate in a clockwise direction beginning with the quadrant after the one the patient indicates is tender or painful. End with the quadrant the patient indicates is tender or painful. If the most painful area is palpated first, the patient may guard against further examination, making your assessment more difficult and less reliable. 5. Remember to be very gentle when palpating the abdomen. Occasionally, an organ within the abdomen will be enlarged and very fragile, and rough palpation could cause further damage. If you see a pulsating mass, do not touch it. Doing so could cause the aorta to rupture. 6. Palpate the four quadrants of the abdomen gently to determine whether each quadrant is tense, guarded, or soft when palpated. 7. Note whether the pain is localized to a particular quadrant or diffuse, widespread. 8. Palpate and wait for the patient to respond, looking for a facial grimace or a verbal ouch. Do not ask the patient, "Does it hurt here?" as you palpate. 9. Determine whether the patient exhibits rebound tenderness, may be tender when direct pressure is applied, but very painful when pressure is released. This is an indicator of peritonitis. When you are palpating for rebound tenderness, you should use extreme caution. 10. Determine whether the patient can relax the abdominal wall on command. 11. Guarding and rigidity may be detected. Guarding is tensing of the abdominal wall muscles. Vital signs. Findings of a high respiratory rate with a normal pulse rate and blood pressure may indicate the patient is unable to ventilate properly because deep breathing causes pain. A high respiratory rate and pulse rate with signs of shock, such as pallor and diaphoresis, profuse sweating, may indicate septic or hypovolemic shock. Monitoring devices. Use pulse oximetry and non-invasive blood pressure devices when these monitoring devices are available. It is recommended that you always assess the patient's first blood pressure manually with a sphygmomanometer, blood pressure cuff, and stethoscope. Reassessment. Because it is often difficult to determine the cause of an acute abdominal emergency, it is extremely important to reassess your patient frequently to determine whether the patient's condition has changed. Remember, the condition of a patient with an acute abdomen can change rapidly from stable to unstable. Vital signs must be reassessed and compared with the patient's baseline vital signs. If anything changes en route to the hospital, manage the problem and document any changes or additional treatment. Reassess the patient and then ask and answer the following questions, where appropriate. Has the patient's level of consciousness changed? Has the patient become more anxious? Have the skin signs begun to change? Has the pain gotten better or worse? Has bleeding become worse or better? Is current treatment improving the patient's condition? Has an already identified problem gotten better? Has an already identified problem gotten worse? What is the nature of any newly identified problems? Interventions. Interventions generally include treatment for shock and providing emotional support. Administer oxygen, cover the patient with a blanket for warmth, and provide gentle transport for the patient without delay. Place the patient in a position of comfort. You will find that patients want to be supine with their knees drawn up. If the patient wants to lay on his or her side, try to make that possible. Be sure that you can observe and maintain the patient's airway because vomiting is common. If the patient's pain is extreme or he or she is showing significant signs of shock, consider the use of ALS assistance, if available, for intravenous fluids and pain management. If transport time is extended and rapid transport is needed, consider air medical, if available. Communication and documentation. Communicate with the receiving hospital early to allow hospital staff to recruit the resources necessary to treat your patient on arrival. Carefully document your findings in your patient care report and relay all relevant information to the receiving physician or nurse. This information should include updated vital signs, changes in the patient's level of consciousness, and any new or worsening complaints. Emergency medical care. Although you cannot treat the causes of acute abdomen, you can take steps to provide comfort and lessen the effects of shock by reassuring the patient and making the patient feel at ease. Treat the patient for shock even when obvious signs of shock are not apparent. Position patients who are vomiting to maintain a patent airway. Contain the vomitus to prevent the spread of infections by using a biohazard bag. Airborne bacteria and viruses produced from vomiting can be easily transmitted to others. Ensure you are wearing gloves, eye protection, and a gown to prevent contamination of yourself, and wear a mask to prevent breathing in any infectious organisms. When you have released your patient to the hospital staff, clean the ambulance and any equipment you have used, preferably with an antibacterial cleaner. Do not forget to wash your hands even though you are wearing gloves. Providing the patient low-flow oxygen often decreases the nausea. If the patient is having problems breathing, high concentrations of oxygen are more appropriate. Elevate the patient's legs to facilitate blood flow to the core of the body and improve circulation. Loosen restrictive clothing and transport gently in a position of comfort. You should constantly reassess your patient's condition for signs of deterioration. Kidney dialysis. The only definitive treatment in chronic cases of kidney failure is peritoneal dialysis or hemodialysis. In these processes, the patient's blood is filtered and cleansed of the toxins and then returned to the body. The treatment eliminates waste, normalizes the blood chemistry, and reduces excess fluid. if a patient misses a dialysis treatment, weakness and pulmonary edema can be the first in a series of conditions that can become progressively more serious if normal balance is not returned to the patient's body. The only time you will most likely see such a machine is if your service transports patients to and from dialysis centers. If there is a dialysis machine in a private residence, treatments will most likely be performed by a trained dialysis technician. In hemodialysis, the patient's blood circulates through a dialysis machine that functions in much the same way as the normal kidneys. Most patients undergoing long-term hemodialysis have some sort of shunt, i.e., a surgically created connection between a vein and an artery. The patient is connected to the dialysis machine through this shunt, which allows blood to flow from the body into the dialysis machine and back to the body. Some patients have an internal shunt, fistula, which is an artificial connection, graft, between a vein and an artery that is usually located in the forearm or upper arm. In peritoneal dialysis, large amounts of specially formulated dialysis fluid are infused into and back out of the abdominal cavity. This fluid stays in the cavity for 1 to 2 hours, allowing equilibrium to occur. Peritoneal dialysis is very effective, but carries a high risk of peritonitis. With proper training, however, peritoneal dialysis can be performed in the home. The adverse effects of dialysis include hypotension, muscle cramps, nausea and vomiting, hemorrhage from the access site, and infection at the access site. If your call involves a patient on dialysis, start with the ABCs. Assess and manage the airway, breathing, and circulation. Provide high-flow oxygen and manage any bleeding from the access site. Position the patient sitting up in cases of pulmonary edema, or supine if the patient is in shock, and transport promptly. Many dialysis patients also have urinary catheters. The catheter is placed in the bladder so the urine can run into a bag. These catheters can often be a source of infection. The patient may report fever and general malaise, illness, in addition to any symptoms specific to kidney failure. Leave the device in place, treat any signs and symptoms, and transport the patient for further evaluation. During transport, unless there is a life-threatening event, make all attempts to deliver the patient to a hospital with dialysis capability.